You're tuned to Witchcraft on the Air, course number 3 of 5, a course in basic witchcraft. We'll be starting out tonight with the Wheel of the Year. And before we jump into the vast subject of the Wheel of the Year, I want to point out there's many variations of the Wheel of the Year in at least 8 90-minute classes could be given on the Wheel of the Year. At least one. You could do one class on each of the pagan holidays. And the variations that we'll be covering today tend to be the most common in the various strains of witchcraft that I have come across and become familiar with, and some of the points where they agree. Please remember lesson one: there is no one right and only way. So if you're sincere with your path and are following along, you'll want to dig deeper. That is our nature, after all. To have to dig deeper. The type of person that has to follow the weaves to their end. Find out what it's all about. The Wheel of the Year represent the 8 holy days, high and low holy days, of the pagan and Wiccan calendar. And the basic philosophy of all of this is the joining with the forces of nature by recognizing key points in the cycles of nature, by acting within these key cycles in ritual fashion, and becoming a part of the natural flow of planetary energies, of solar energies, of the energies of plants and animals. For we are a nature religion. Some of us forget that with all this concrete around. An old philosophy amongst us goes: to know the cycles within yourself and without yourself is the makings of a witch, and the true mystery traditions is to know that as above, so below, as the universe, so the soul. To know the universe, we must know the currents that flow within ourselves and the currents that flow in the planet around us, and how to better work with those. In the pagan calendar of the Wheel of the Year is called such because it's viewed as an 8-spoked wheel showing the holidays and their opposition holidays, their opposite holidays, in the grand calendar. And this is the main thing. This is what it's all about. The variations are vast, and we'll cover as many as we can. I want to point out, before we jump in modern usage, in modern Wicca, the Wheel of the Year, solar and earth holidays, the cycles of growth of plants and animals, are commonly used with more modern themes attached, because seemingly in our society, animals and plants aren't deemed to be as important or as necessary for survival. We are no longer hunters and gatherers. We are shoppers and consumers. The Wheel of the Year holidays represent growth and harvest cycles. Originally, cycles of plants and animals. But in modern usage, in modern Wicca, used to represent many modern concepts, harvesting is no longer only viewed as the harvesting of plants, but the harvesting of everything that you sow, the seeds that you plant, the magic that you make. Run alongside with the cycles of plant growth. The wheel of the year marks the movements of the sun and the growth and mating cycles of plants and animals, and specific plants and specific animals depending on geographical region. But the dates and the main concepts of holidays remain remarkably similar all around the world. The eight-spoked wheel of the witches' sabbats, or holy days, containing four major holy days and four minor. Generally speaking, solstices and equinoxes are minor holidays, marking sun progression. Equinoxes marking the times of equal day and equal night. Solstices marking the high point or the low point of sun activity, winter solstice being low, summer solstice being high. Most commonly, the wheel begins at the point where the light half of the year meets the dark half. As we move into the dark, and the first high holiday of the Wiccan calendar is the holiday of Samhain, known by common culture as Halloween. Samhain in English actually looks like the word Samhain, and some people mistakenly pronounce the word as Samhain, but if you see the word Samhain, it's actually pronounced Samhain, pronounced more like S-O-W-A-N. It's also known as the Time of Shadows, or November's Eve. Traditionally, this holiday is held late at night on October 31st and into November 1st. This is one of the reasons that midnight on Halloween is seen as the witching hour, even in movies and storybooks. These times between the light and half, the light half and the dark half, are seen as the times when the veil between the worlds is thinnest. Magic is strongest, depending on the type of magic done. Samhain is the last harvest. Again, these harvest rituals are commonly used for more modern things, like, you know, getting jobs and apartments and, you know, paying the cable bill on time. But it's important to not obscure these original harvest and hunting rituals, as it should become quite important someday. Unless this culture lasts in its present form, these cycles will become very important. And remembered by our children as such, and can teach you a lot about the growth of certain food crops and herbs as well. Let's see. Samhain, the veil between what we consider life and death, is the thinnest. Traditionally, it was the time to honor our ancestors, communicate with those who have gone before. Rites of divination, future telling, crystal balls, tarot cards are very commonly done at this time, as it is seen that the things that influence those energies are most easily contacted when the veils are the thinnest. Trick-or-treat is an odd tradition, I suppose, that has survived in a really obscured capitalist form, of course. You know, kids going on the door, banging on the door and begging for corporate candy, but in an obscure kind of way, some of the ritual stays intact. Children dress up as monsters and ghosty things, and trick-or-treat, the original terminology was that on that night, your ancestors would come looking for treats, being ghostly types, out-of-body types. If they didn't receive a treat, they would be offended. And, you know, since they're your ancestors, of course, you know, they probably wouldn't do anything too terrible to you, but things of the other world can be very tricky. And they would play tricks on you, and they hide, in this modern day and age, hide your car keys and whatnot. Very common things that will mess with you, hence trick or treat. Best to leave a treat. Samhain was the feast of the dead, and the dead came back to Earth to roam amongst their own again. So offerings of food would be placed out for them. Whatever was consumed by the family, whatever the meal was, a portion of each of the entrees would be set aside for the ancestors. Very commonly, this is sacrifice. Sacrifice gets obscured by our enemies over time, and the word brings up some very ugly pictures in the mind. The sacrifice in our culture originally meant giving of something that was precious to you, to your God, to your ancestors, to the planet. And being that the idea of whether or not the planet can use, you know, your quarter pounder with cheese or not is irrelevant. The fact is that it's something that you deem necessary for you to survive. Even, you know, some of you consider your quarter pounder with cheese necessary for your survival, and you're giving up a portion of that. The idea is very strong, and the intent carries over into the other world and is known. Most commonly, these sacrifices are given up to the elements or left outside where in solar rituals where the sun would shine upon them, and lunar where the moon would shine upon them, left to the air, left to the fire. Burnt offerings are held sacred in a lot of traditions, thrown in the ocean, hanging from a tree. This was the Dumb Supper. In some cultures, and still held in some traditions today, this was the time when the maiden aspect of the goddess goes into the underworld and starts her journey beyond the veils in order to learn the mysteries of death, bring them back to her people, her chosen ones in some traditions. And this is the reign of the Dark God as he travels death. This period of time is the best time for learning the hidden craft, which is spoken on the wind within nature. Crystal balls and black mirrors are often consecrated at this time, often charged at this time, and even more often just used at this time as that which they touch. Again, the veil between here and there is again the thinnest, the easiest time for peering across the void with any agency of divination that you happen to use. The times when a full moon would fall on one of these high holidays were held more sacred, more closer to these holidays. And the time when the full moon occurred near Samhain, or before Samhain, or on Samhain, as close as you could get to Samhain, was also a common time for charging crystal balls, as crystal balls traditionally charged by the moon. In the majority of traditions that have a traditional construct around that, they are moon tools. Tools of the moon, charged with the light thereof. And I'll give you this. Mugwort brewed into a tea is very commonly found in older and newer schools, and something that's survived, but still not talked about, because not too many books even cover crystal balls very much at all. Except maybe a book on crystal balls specifically. There's one or two of those around. Basically, the crystal ball is bathed in a tea solution once it's cooled down of mugwort, as dark as you can possibly get it. A smaller ball with a larger vessel could be immersed completely in the fluid for a time when the moon could shine upon it. Better yet, brewed in a cauldron, of course, over an open fire is best, but takes longer to cool. And that's one side that survived, but another part of this particular one that I learned was the use of a magnifying glass to charge the crystal. I never forgot that one, because I've only charged one crystal ball personally in my life, and it's an extremely dramatic experience. Focusing the directed light of the moon through a magnifying glass for a long enough period of time into the center of a crystal ball is really something, and I'll just have to leave it at that and let you see it for yourself, should you be a crystal ball driven type of person. Likewise, the Black Mirror is also bathed in a similar solution of mugwort tea. Some other variations containing cinquefoil, sandalwood, but always mugwort. I've not seen the same ritual with the magnifying glass used on a Black Mirror, but it seems completely relevant. Could work there as well. You give it a try and tell me. Black candles are common around this time. Black candles spook some people out that aren't part of the craft, but this time they merely represent darkness, the unknown, the burning away of the unknown, lifting of that veil. It's not such a scary concept. I'm sure there are some warp traditions out there that do nastier things with them, but it's not very common. Coming up after Samhain, usually going counterclockwise around the wheel, is the winter solstice, also known as Yule, and of course many other names depending on geographical location. Yule tends to fall around December 21st, when the sun enters Capricorn. But that may not always be the case. But when the sun enters Capricorn, this is a time when the sun reaches its lowest point, starts its progression up. The sun is reborn. It's the birth of the sun god, most commonly in most traditions. Even those that didn't tend to be solar worshippers. There are births of other nature gods happening around this time too, depending on your tradition, but the most common is the birth of the sun god. When the sun starts its progression up, it should be noted that early biblical scholars looking for a date to date the birth of Jesus, or the Son of God, could find no date, and chose the nearest, commonest holy day associated with the birth of God, for some reason that they failed to disclose. And they set it to be near, again, the winter solstice. This is the longest night of the year. In some traditions, it's customary to be aware and awake and in a ritual setting, or to be aware and awake in a semi-ritual setting from sundown to sunup, or in others, to the exact moment the sun enters Capricorn. Again, would behoove us to take some astronomy classes, unless you count on the astrological guide calendar or Llewellyn's almanac to arrive in the mail forever. A curious old tradition that seems to have been warped and kept alive, other than the present delivering elf, was the Yule tree. The Yule tree, although really warped now, is obviously where the Christmas tree came from. But it was traditional to bring a tree into the house, but it was a live tree. A tree in a clay pot. And yes, pines were very traditional in lands that had pines. Dried fruit, berries, colorful, edible things would be hung upon this tree in a ritual setting, very often by the children. Edible things that could be consumed by birds and animals. After the solstice, the tree would be taken out and planted in the forest. It would be covered in birds and animals right away because it had food all over it. Initiating a tree to the forest, playing a part of that at that sacred time, playing a part with nature. What a novel concept in these days. I really would like to know whoever got the idea of killing a tree and then bringing it into your house and watching it decay. Some things are warped over time, but we can put them back together. A far more sustainable tradition, and I should think of all those people doing Christmas trees over the years that adopted the Yule tree. Of course, this world will be a different place, but we don't have time to go into that, do we? Also, the Yule log is traditional in a lot of cultures and is one of the things that survives into the archaic Christian and Catholic rituals and is commonly seen in families that think themselves church-going, God-fearing people, unknowing of the original roots of the tradition. Quite commonly, the Yule log was constructed from a section of the maypole from the last May. Quite often, this was a birch tree or some other solar tree. Candles, quite commonly red and green, would be placed into the log, holes drilled into the log, to be burnt on it. sometimes gold candles or gold colored candles. And also quite commonly the Yule log was to be thrown into the bale fire or the ritual fire of the celebration, to be a token part of it, or to be the first part to start the fire, again, depending on traditions. And the Yule log is again obscured, and you can around Christmas time you can buy it. I've seen a thing called the Yule log on the shelves, which is a bunch of cheese mashed together in a log form called a Yule log. Curious times, kids. Some women's mysteries center around a type of spiritual midwifery at this time. Well, again, you know, how do you know? Birch, you're a man. In some traditions, of knowing the mysteries, or at least the base overlaying mysteries, what can be known by the other gender is part of initiation, and this much I know. There's of course much more to it, but spiritual midwifery of a sort, assisting the goddess through labor until the sun has passed into its low point, again sitting up all night, very commonly done in some traditions by the priestesses, or the priestesses in waiting. Men go off and do some other thing. And in some traditions, they work together. Whatever works best for you. Staying with the goddess through labor until the sun has reached its low point, which would be the birth, the moment of birth of the god. In Druidic traditions, this would be the moment that the high priest would cut the mistletoe from the oak. Very high ritual of the time. Again, some of those traditions that survive, the mistletoe being cut from the oak, again, a symbol of fertility and love. Union of the god and goddess. And I'm sure in old days they did a lot more than kiss beneath them. Gifts were traditionally offered to the newborn god, again obscuring into the capitalist traditions of today. Incense of frankincense and myrrh were offered up to the god, quite commonly in some older traditions. Those traditions usually offering a combination of frankincense and myrrh and gold. Sometimes the frankincense and myrrh burnt. Sometimes the gold tossed in the fire. But more often, the gold will be given to a worthy cause. Gold being the metal of the sun, symbolic of the sun, was sacrificed, given to a worthy cause or to the work of the old ways. Healing flowers and plants, and also gifts, were offered to the goddess mother this time. And I don't know if they were delivered by a fat elf and a bunch of reindeer. That's another tradition, I'm sure. Coming up next in the wheel is Imbolc. Imbolc, I-M-B-O-L-C, a common spelling, and again, many other names. But it tends to fall around February 1st or February 2nd, and one of those traditions absorbed into the Catholic ritual structure as the holiday of Candlemas. And there are some Wiccan traditions that call it Candlemas. This is commonly a festival of purification by fire. The goddess is recovered from birthing, but simultaneously, in some traditions, another aspect of the goddess, again, the maiden aspect, who is previously back at Samhain, gone into the underworld. The goddess's maiden self, who's been through the underworld and unveiled the mysteries of death, is preparing to return to the surface of the earth to bring life, make it fertile again. Another one of those fire festivals. Fires and candles are lit, a large amount. Quite possibly because in some of those cultures it was very cold about now, and you'd want a bunch of fires going. Fires and candles are lit to light the goddess's way back from the underworld. Of course, I'm sure she doesn't need our candles, but it's the idea, right? Intent is half the game. A fragment of this tradition still remains in the Catholic Candlemas rituals. Candles and burning of mass quantities of candles all night for some obscure reason remains still. Is the spring equinox, Ostara, which is commonly held March 20th or the 21st, or when the sun enters Aries. Day and night are in balance, with the light growing. It's a festival of the awakening of the earth. Fertility symbology and fertility rituals are quite commonly practiced. And in some older days, these fertility rituals were for the tribes themselves. Also very commonly for the plants, the crops that those particular tribes needed to survive. And in other times, in other cultures, for the animals that needed to be hunted during that time of year for the tribe to survive. Rituals of joining with those forces, those animals, those plants, acknowledging the part that we all play. It's not just hacking and consuming. It's a cycle of life and death. And you are what you eat. And what we eat becomes a part of us. Our ancestors acknowledged that with these rituals. But at sometimes, these fertility rites were very necessary for the survival of the tribe. Especially the older crafts. And during the times of plagues. And during the times of persecution. Again, for the fertility of the witch blood in the hereditary tribes. And the fertility of those who would be born with that mindset for the craft to survive. In modern times, these fertility rites are used for the fertility of ideas, for the fertility of personal growth, financial growth, domestic tranquility. And yes, some of us still grow plants. So it is, again, for the fertility of our plants. Some traditions had rituals where the maidens at the time of menstruation would dance through the fields, ritual dance to bring back the fertility of the land. And of all the different pagan reasons, the giving of the energy of dance to the planet, the joining of the cycles of life, moving with those cycles, if those reasons weren't good enough to bring the fertility of the crops, very scientifically, the menstrual blood is extremely nutritious for the soil, for the plants. Women bleed the majority of their vitamins out, especially like iron and whatnot, at this time. And since it's going out anyways, it's really good for the ground. Our ancestors were not stupid. There was always a reason to be skipping through the forest. And why the hell not? Fertility symbols such as eggs have survived, Easter eggs. Although, again, bizarre and distorted by our bizarre and distorted culture, but in Celtic societies and in others as well, red eggs survives. Red painted eggs at this time as symbols of fertility. Other cultures had different colors that they had for fertility, so green eggs were commonly seen as well. Green eggs and ham. Hairs were fertility symbols quite commonly used around this time. Not just rabbits, but hares. The symbology here should be obvious. Hares spend a lot of time engaging in fertility rituals. And again, somewhere along the lines warps into the Easter Bunny, ringing fertility symbols, hopping down the bunny trail. Oh my goodness, who knows how these things happen over time. Spring equinox was the first day of spring. Jumping bonfires for fertility was quite common. Yes, jumping bonfires, usually naked, because it's much too dangerous to jump through the fire with your clothes on. The idea being that the god of fire would cleanse the soul and make them fruitful. Next on the wheel is the high holiday of Beltane, sometimes called May Day, May Eve, and in some cultures, a combination of two rituals, one lasting all night, April 30th, the night of revelry and chaos, and quite often death in some cultures. Ritual battles were fought between the powers of winter and the powers of spring. And in some cultures, the loser died. And far, far back, the loser was sacrificed. And the winner was the priest the next day on May Day. May Day, it's commonly called Beltane as well. But in those cultures that had the adjoining ritual, Beltane, there was Beltane Eve and Beltane, or Beltane Eve and May Day. Two rituals that kind of flow into one. Two rituals that go great together. Revelry all night long, and then when the sun comes up, the different rituals start. This is the day opposite Samhain. And again, the veils are thinnest. This time, it's the veil of birth versus the veil of death. When the spirits of our ancestors await rebirth and gather amongst us, waiting for people to enact those old fertility rites. Very special children are often conceived on this day or within several days following, and quite possibly within several days before. Again, the veils are thinnest. This was the time in some cultures when the goddess became pregnant again to give birth to the sun god, the winter solstice. Fertility. Fertility and lust are the main themes, and these are things reveled in pagan culture, in pagan society, and before the coming of the church, reveled in by the people. The gifts of pleasure of the goddess was always held as a prime sacrament, overlooked in a lot of modern Wiccan schools. Some of the old rituals have derived to symbolic sexual union, and that's okay. Some people have different ways, but in some cultures, the sexual union was much more than symbolic. The young god is reaching manhood, and the maiden goddess is becoming woman. As the mating chase of spring begins, this theme lasts to this day in a lot of Wiccan groups and a lot of just pagan groups. The chase of spring originally was a ritual held quite commonly on May Day. It was a women's choice ritual where a woman, by some indication, indicated to somebody else, quite commonly it's seen as a man, but again, we have no regulations on people's sexuality. So somebody playing the role of the dominant side, or the top, if you will, of the relationship would be chosen by the woman in some symbolic way. And then she'd run away. And they would give chase into the woods, where she would decide where she would be caught. And when they caught each other, they would engage in sexual union in the dirt. And that is a prime pagan sacrament. And adjoining with the energies of the earth at that time and the mating rituals of everything else in the forest, and was not seen as an ugly thing or a sin. Modern usage, the chase of spring, quite commonly, is still a woman's choice ritual, usually starting with whoever is priestess or playing the part of the maiden goddess at the time, again, symbolically choosing someone from the crowd, tossing them a flower, giving them a scarf, some way, and then they give chase, usually around the circle, round and around and around, and then they catch, embrace, and kiss. Sure, loses a lot of flair over time, but we are in different times. The great rite, the rite of sexual union between the male and female, or the male counterpart and the female counterpart, the top and the bottom, again, if you will, was one of the prime rituals in witchcraft, and still is, but is now more commonly done, at least in public circles, symbolically by the joining of the athame, sometimes the wand, and the cup, symbol of the goddess and the god. The phallus and the vagina. Symbolic is all over. The symbolic acts of sexual union is all over May Day and Beltane and cannot be missed and just cannot be obscured even by the most anally retentive of us. Let's see. All of the forest is frolicking. The mating chase of spring with the animals, with the humans is happening. Common rituals include the maypole, basically a phallic trunk of a sacred tree. A tree sacred to the sun, quite often, is inserted into the earth. The participants dance around the pole. The sun is mating the earth, impregnating the earth with itself, in a way, to be born again at the solstice. If my timing is correct, the tape should be flipping any moment. We'll be back momentarily. You're listening to Witchcraft on the Air, tape 3 of 5. Side B of tape 3. Let's see, where the heck did I leave off? Yes, the maypole. Maypole is one of those traditions to survive in all kinds of other cultures. Of course, the communists still use the maypole. As the communist was a peasant class movement. They kept some of those peasant holidays alive, but in very seemingly sedate cultures and right under the nose of the church, the maypole survives and can even be seen in shopping malls sometimes around this time. Matter of fact, I think the city of Santa Cruz had a May Day sale last year. Let's see, a sacred tree, or a phallic trunk of the sacred tree is inserted into the earth. Quite commonly, ribbons of red and white, again symbolic of fertility, are tied to the top of the pole. At the bottom, the participants dance around the pole, weaving in and out of each other. One group going clockwise, one going counterclockwise, within, without, and if nobody screws up, it weaves its way down the pole, weaving between each other and weaving the ribbons around the pole, and the goddess becomes pregnant with the sun god again. The goddess makes things blossom, gives buds, brings back the fertility of the earth. And there's much rejoicing. Because we like to rejoice, you see. Next round the wheel brings us to the summer solstice, June 21st to June 23rd, somewhere in there. When the sun enters Leo. There we go. The sun enters Leo. The sun is at its high point at the summer solstice, going towards its dark point. The powers of nature reach their peak. Bonfires are lit to the sun. tradition I've come across that survives was kind of off the wall. The lighting of wheels, sometimes 8-spoked wheels, on hilltops, rolled downhill to show the digression of the sun, quite often into the ocean. Well, if you've got a big enough ritual spot where you can roll a burning wheel downhill, there's an old thing to throw into your ritual. Would be quite dramatic, I should think. Never seen it done, except in my head. The peak of the powers of nature. Again, one of those fire festivals, even though it's hot. Lots of fires. Baal fires. To the goddess Baal, another one of those sun fire gods of Celtic times. Quite often lit at the summer solstice. So has May Day. In some traditions, this marks the point of the death of the sun god. And this is important to note in our general mythos. The goddess, though she transcends the world of death to find the mysteries thereof, the goddess never dies. None of the aspects of the goddess tend to die. They go through cycles of maiden, mother, crone, and then back to maiden again. The god goes through cycles of continual life and death, being born again on one aspect at the point of death. The point of death of the sun god becomes the lord of death. In some traditions, other gods are born at this point. Nature gods. Animal gods. The god is symbolically sacrificed, and probably in older cultures may have been sacrificed. But that would have to take us way, way back. But ritually sacrificed. Symbolically sacrificed. A fake death for the person performing God, or the image symbolizing God. Again, life and death in pagan culture are different than the common concept. Every end of a path is the beginning of another. The end of a life is the beginning of a life. So when the sun god dies, parts of him are going to become the lord of death. Parts of God become reborn as grain deities. John Barleycorn, Jack of the Green, depending on your culture. Grain gods reborn into the life of the fields after the sun has reached its peak and given all of its energy into those fields and into those crops, reforms into the various grain and plant gods. Growth rituals are done at this time. Next on the wheel is Lunasa, or Lammas, and I've heard somebody pronounce it Lunasad, but I believe more commonly in the Gaelic, it is spelled Lughnasadh, the D-H is commonly pronounced differently than in America, Kikin. Lunasa. Lammas. Lunasa. The Feast of Lu. August 1st. Quite literally, the Feast of Lu, the god of the sun. In the mythos, made possible by sacrificing himself in the summer, has made the grains fruitful. In some cultures, the fruit fruitful. By sacrificing himself, loaves of bread are baked, shaped like a man, or shaped like the sun. We're baked and eaten, and offered to the God, sacrificed. Literally, the eating of the body of God. Thereby becoming one with that body of God, taking that God into you, becoming one with it. We are what we eat. This is the pagan Thanksgiving. Time of abundant harvest. Also in Celtic mythos, quite commonly, was a time of the marriage rite of two of the prime deities, the god Lu and the goddess Eru, translating into the earth. The marriage rite of the sun and the earth. Again, setting pagan traditions quite apart from others. The god and goddess get married after the goddess is quite pregnant for several months, I might add. That somehow lasts as a tradition. Marriage rite, not like the Christian marriage rite, is a hand fasting, a joining of two people or two deities for love's sake alone, for as long as love shall last. Not till death do you part, and not forsaking all others, or any of the common terminology that goes with marriage, hand fasting, the joining because they want to be joined. Some cultures, this is referred to as a trial marriage. A hand fasting. A trial marriage for a year and a day. In some Celtic traditions, it's quite common for the participants to engage in hand fastings at this time. May Day, in some traditions, again, is a common time for hand fastings. But I want to make clear, there's just the concept of hand fasting. One of the most common rituals seen in hand fasting is when the couple are holding hands, the clergy, if you will, the priest and priestess, throw a cord around their hands, quite commonly making three bends around the hand, or three twists around the hands, but it's never tied. And again, that's not always true. In some traditions, it is tied, but it's not a knot. It's only just one loop through, a loose bind. I bind thee loosely, is the common words given to the couple at this time. Bound for as long as love shall last. And again, the rite of the hand fasting of Lu and Eru, the joining of the sun and the earth, symbolically carried out in some traditions at this time. The priest and priestess will symbolically get hand fasted. Coming up after Lunasa brings us to Mabon, September 21st. Through the 23rd. The fall equinox. The sun enters Libra. It is the second harvest of that which we planted usually around May Day or the spring equinox. This is a harvest of not only food, we harvest what we have sown, what we ritually planted during the ritually planting season. Quite commonly, seeds are planted in the May Day rituals to be harvested now at Maybon or at one of the other harvest festivals. The god journeys towards death, and the goddess again journeys to another of her aspects of crone, or wise woman, while simultaneously another part of her prepares to become mother again. It is a time of gathering in sustenance to prepare for winter. And that brings us back to Samhain again, and the cycle continues. So do this, if you've got a piece of paper, and draw a circle with an equal arm cross through it. And we've discussed this one a few times. Again, like a plus sign. Four spokes equally across each other. A plus sign in the middle of a circle. Just this marks the high pagan holidays. And let's see, this, I'm trying to make this easy to remember. If you just look at it, the basic concept, the top of the wheel is the beginning of the wheel and is Samhain. Opposite of Samhain would be May Day. Got that? So, at the top half, or at the top of the wheel, the side of the wheel to the right is the dark half of the year, and the side of the wheel to the left is the light half of the year. The first quarter of the dark half of the year is quite commonly the time of preparation in plant mythos, and the mythos that works its way into witchcraft and the rituals, the seasonal rituals thereof. It's the time of preparation for what you will be planting. Hopefully we can see far enough to our long-term goals. We're preparing soil, we're preparing our lives towards that which we will plant in the next quarter of the wheel. So that's the first quarter after Samhain on the right hand. And below it is the planting quarter of the year. We sow our seeds, our ideas, we plant our goals that we will hopefully still want several months down the road. It's important during these ritual cycles to keep a large view. Don't plant things that are only needed for the moment. Planting time takes us to its peak at May Day, the peak of planting time. And then the next quarter, coming up the left hand of the circle, is the growth time. The growth of that which we planted, the concepts, the ideas, the framework, growing during that quarter. And then the last quarter is the harvest portion of the year. That takes us through the basic Wiccan and pagan wheel of the year. And again, there's extremely much more detailed information to be found on any of these. Some of our recommended reading lists, you know, such as The Spiral Dance, Buckland's Complete Book of Witchcraft, even true magic, I believe, most of them tend to cover it. Most of Scott Cunningham's books, Wicca for the Solitary Practitioner, definitely covers it. And everybody's going to have their own take on it, but the main overlaying themes, as I've given them to you, are some of the most common and the most agreed upon between our bickering sides. A lot of us can't agree. A lot of us believe that we have to. Again, there's no one right way. The Wheel of the Year represent a large portion of the Wiccan mythos and the ritual structure. But again, these are solar rituals and earth rituals. There's another large side, as you might imagine, and has hardly been mentioned so far. And that's the moon. The moon rituals. The Sabbats are the point of sun movement and plant growth and animal cycles, but there is another side being practiced in between and in conjunction with all of them. During the month that the moon becomes full, in the same sign that the sun is in at the time, is an extremely powerful moon. Combinations of moon power times and sun power times are times of great magical potential. Times when these two constructs fall together on a high pagan holiday, why? That's potential for big earth-changing magic and connection with your deity, your higher self, the planet, the god, goddess, all that is, or what have you. And the moon is a large part. The moon changes more rapidly. The moon affects the tides and the liquid flow through plants, as we are made of liquid, ugly bags of mostly water, blood, and fluid. We are extremely susceptible to the moon, and some of us more than others. But joining with these cycles, knowing of these cycles, working with these cycles is as of prime importance as working with the cycles of the sun, of trees, of plants, the ocean, or whatever floats your boat. The Esbets were rites of the moon. E-S-B-A-T-S, for those of you that are writing. In much traditional and modern witchcraft, or Wicca, the full moon and the new moon are held sacred, as these are seen as aspects of the goddess and specific points of progression in the cycle of the moon. And these aspects of the moon are seen as aspects of the goddess. The new to near full is the maiden cycle of the moon. The near full to mid waning, waning being the portion where the moon goes from full towards dark, are the mother aspect of the moon. Mother aspect reaching peak at the full moon, when the moon is seen as pregnant and ready to give birth to the magics being done. The waning and dark moon is the crone aspect of the goddess, and it's sometimes forgotten in a lot of modern traditions. Commonly in modern Wicca, Esbat equals full moon. It means only full moon. Way back when I was a kid, they said Esbet. It meant new moon and full moon, or dark moon and full moon, depending on how specific your tradition was. The sacred nights of the goddess's peak of power. The new moon is one peak, the peak of the hidden side of power. Full moon, the peak of the seen side of power. As soon as the sun sets, the full moon rises. And there are 13 full moons in a year. The moon is heralded as Diana, Tana, closely linked with Aradia, and many, many others. Mostly goddesses. I've not seen too many gods of the moon. And others vary by tradition. The older term Esbat meant the new moon, the dark moon, or the full moon. Both needed to be practiced in groups that were keeping with the cycles. The dark and the new moon were the time of the dark goddess, the time of menstruation. And scientifically, I have heard of research that women that live in places more connected with the earth, you know, live in tents, yurts, sleeping bags, and removed from the electromagnetic fields of electrical lines flowing through your house, women that live outside of those fields and more connected to the earth tend to revert or not revert, progress towards this cycle of menstruation, to where they menstruate near the new moon, which is seen the natural time for that to happen before electricity and birth control pills and all of these things. Menstruation was considered a woman's time of power, a time when the fertility was flowing through her fertile parts. Was not seen as a bad thing. A friend of mine used to refer to it as her holy time. She would skip through the house. It's my holy time! It's my holy time! It seemed much better than those that are miserable and upset about it and, you know, guilty about it. Some religions are quite silly and like to make people guilty. The most naturalist of things. Well, that would not be us. We help hold these things as very sacred. And not only because menstrual blood's good for the plants, but it's good for the women that bleed. It's part of the process. Make sure that everything works. It was not always such a sin. This is the time of women's mysteries, the time of Hecate. Many hidden crafts. Interesting to note, Hecate, whose totem animal, the dog, is one of the words that over time, through the constant bashing of the feminine principles of deity by the church, over time, one of her names was bitch. Over time, that's become a nasty word and an ugly word. And it once meant a goddess herself, was a powerful thing. And that power pissed some men in power off. So they made it an ugly thing. The new moon is the time for planting. Again, the new moon around May is a time for the planting of great magics, the time for planting of great works and long-term goals, the more powerful planting time. But depending on the plant and the plant's necessary needs, the new moon is the best time to plant. Of course, you would need to do it the right time of year, again, depending on the plant, but the time for also planting our ideas. A full moon is a time of completing, manifesting, goddess giving birth. In one of our older documents, Aradia, Gospel of the Witches, the goddess is seen as delivering a message to the people by way of her daughter Aradia, or Aradia, or Aradia, or Aradia, depending on where you're from. Many Wiccan traditions have absorbed and somewhat changed this original message, and other traditions claim that they hold the original of that message, but in all versions of that message, some things remain the same. That once in the month, and best it be when the moon is full, you shall assemble in some secret place and adore the spirit of she, the moon, and is queen of all witchery. Gather in a circle of the arts, and secrets shall be revealed. Make music, dance, feast, and love, all in her praise. Whenever you have need of anything, some traditions, 3 works of magic can be performed at this night. But in the traditions that hold that portion of the goddess mythos sacred, that's the prime time to ask for something personally, a personal work of magic that you want the aspects of the moon to work with. That was the time. Sometimes, depending on the need, a pre-ritual would be started at the new moon and completed at the full. The new moon to the full moon, the time when the new moon goes towards the full moon, is commonly referred to as waxing. And from the full to the new, again, waning. In magics of the moon, the time of waxing is the time of growth and receiving, pulling energies to you, the drawing of things that you want. Waning is the time for the banishing, repelling, and projecting of things that you don't want, or the casting away from you of magics, to thereby go out into the world and then manifest back again in tune with the cycles of the moon. Very commonly, 3 cycles of the moon are needed for some things to manifest. Some things manifest more quickly, but quite commonly, if results are not seen by 3 cycles, something else needs to be tried, or a new goal needs to be pursued. So in keeping with these cycles of the moon, it becomes quite difficult. If you want to keep in tune with the cycles of the planet, the cycles of the moon, but you need to get something done, like, you know, you need health right now, but it's a waning moon. You need to be healthy because you're sick and you're going to die. If you don't, well, you know, you can't wait around till the new moon to work your magic. So you can banish illness and still stick with the concept and accomplish what you want. Always look at things in a different perspective. If you look at something head on, step to the side and look at it from the side. Step to the other side, look at it from the back, from the top, from the bottom. Where there's a witch, there's a way. Likewise, you know, most commonly in our financial society, you know, people might need to do money spells because they're broke and they're going to get evicted. Prosperity spells. And it's a waning moon. Well, you can banish poverty. Well, you need a house. Banish homelessness. Your extra energy might fly out into the world and, you know, banish other homelessness. Or hey, why not just cast that out anyways during the waning moon? Maybe you'll be affected by it too. Sometimes the best things to manifest by works of magic are things done for others with no greed or need attached to them. It's the giving of a gift. It tends to manifest back in your own life. The moon again rises in the east, so a lot of moon rituals are conducted facing east. We're looking to the east. In some traditions, and again, some of those traditions that use that goddess charge mythos, is traditional to practice naked, you know, without clothes, or in the old term, sky clad. Clad only by the sky. That is still kept sacred by some traditions, but depending on how closely the people can work together, I would suggest if you're a solitaire and you can get out under the full moon in nature somewhere, that you should try skyclad. It might be cold, but that which doesn't kill us makes us stronger. And it's something to try. With groups, it can be tricky because we all have bizarre sexual baggage that we carry around and can't deal with being naked. And some of us can't deal with others being naked around them and can't keep their mind on what they're doing. Well, those people should get robes or wear something else. But some of those traditions hold that very sacred and say that that's the only way you can practice. And there's just no such thing. And lastly, in the third course, is the third key. We've discussed three keys. Or two keys, and we'll discuss the third. The three keys of magic, as they were taught to me, and as they were taught to many others. Relaxation, concentration, which you hopefully have worked on in between classes. And the third key, projection. Projection is as important as all the others. Once a magic has been worked or a wish has been concentrated on strong enough, its object has to be cast away. The destruction of the physical component, the symbol, is commonly a practice of projection. A meditation that I recall for practicing the art of projection is a visualization. Again, your first key, your second key will get you to your third key. Relax. Concentrate. You're standing on a seashore. Pick up a rock. Throw the rock to the horizon as far as you can hurl it. Feel yourself throw it. Physically, mentally pushing the rock with your mind towards the horizon. Once that is done, pick up another rock. somehow push it farther. Feel what you pushed before and push harder. Release the rock. See it fly farther towards the horizon. And again, and again, and again, over and over. Practice this one. It was pretty helpful for me. Pushing your magic away, giving it force and sending it out. The force that you send it out with is commonly believed to return threefold. To return threefold of the force that... To return with threefold the force of what it was originally sent out with. Both positive and negative. The harder you push it, the farther you throw it. The better visualizations, like, you know, those of you that are into, you know, modern things, maybe you can visualize a cruise missile launching your will 300 miles across the sea. Of course, I'm kidding, but you see the concept. This is important, and the last major key in all magic. Magic needs to be released. It needs to be let go. You need to relax, build up force by concentrating, visualizing, concentrating on an idea for long enough, and then hurling it away from you through many ritual practices for accomplishing this. But mentally, this is important. Forget. You must forget. A grimoire is quite helpful for these types of things. Or a magical diary or notebook. As soon as finishing this spell, write it down. Write down what you did, what time you did it, everything, every detail that you can think of. And then close the book. And do not think of it again until it is obviously manifested into your life. Or seemingly manifested into your life, and enough time has passed, again, commonly 3 moon cycles, an entire solar cycle, depending on how large the magic, how long-term the goal. Forget it. Some people employ certain herbs that induce forgetfulness at this time. Going to sleep after doing the spell is good. Going and doing something else, and you know, I hate to advocate it, but for some people, watching TV, I would suggest getting a VCR and watching a good movie or something about some mundane thing is good. TV has a very mind-numbing quality. I don't know if you've ever noticed, but people tend to go blank and think about nothing. This process can be used for your benefit. It has been used for your detriment your whole lives. So, watching TV can be witchcraft. And forget. Let it go. Don't think about it. Don't bring it up. And above all, do not talk about it. To know, to dare, and to be silent is our way. And it's the hardest thing in the world to do, because you're going to want to run out and tell everybody. Important to consider at this time is one of the things that I was taught. Words are a physical manifestation energy, and that which you do spiritually that you want to manifest physically can be wasted in words. Talking about it can dissipate the energy of manifestation. Manifesting it onto this plane in only words. And if you talk about it, you have manifested part of the energy on this plane and have made your spell manifest on this plane and have done yourself no good. This has been Witchcraft on the Air. Course 3 of 5. If you're listening on the air, we'll be back not this coming Tuesday, but the Tuesday after that.
We'll be back next Tuesday. That's what he said on the tape.
Merry meet, merry part. Blessed be and good morning, Santa Cruz.
And email me at freakphil@hotmail.com for next week.